Hello, bonjour, and you're very welcome today to our podcast at CMAJ. In Canada, about 500,000 people present to an emergency room with chest pain, but many don't appear to receive follow-up from a physician after discharge, and that's despite the significant benefits associated with follow-up care. I'm Donald McCauley, Associate Editor of CMAJ, and today we're speaking to Dr. Dennis Coe, co-author of a research article that looked at understanding this gap in practice. Dennis, nice to talk to you, and you're based at the Sunnybrook Health Sciences Centre in Toronto, and you're an interventional cardiologist. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. What we were interested in is exactly what you said. We were interested in looking at what happens to patients after they get discharged. You know, there are currently no practice guidelines from the Canadian Cardiovascular Society on this topic. In the United States, interestingly, their guidelines advocate that patients after discharge should see a physician within 22 hours of their emergency room discharge because there's still significant risk of potential adverse complications. These recommendations were largely based on consensus from the United States. But we've looked at this topic before in a paper that we've published approximately a year ago. We looked at patients who had high-risk characteristics, you know, namely those with diabetics as well as prior cardiac conditions, and actually found that when they had physician follow-up with either primary care physician or cardiologist physician follow-up, they actually had significantly improved outcomes with, you know, lower risk of myocardial infarction or death. So in this subsequent paper, we really want to know why they were not seen. And we looked at a cohort in Ontario between April 2004 and 2010. We again looked at this cohort of, you know, higher risk chest pain patients because we didn't feel that all patients may need follow-up after their chest pain visit. And instead of using 72 hours as recommended in the United States, we looked at a time frame of 30 days. And because we felt that this time frame is more realistic in Canadian context. And what we found was that, you know, among the 56,000 patients evaluated in our study, about 1 in 4 patients did not get physician follow-up. So that's about 25%. About 70% were seen by a primary care physician, and about 17% were seen by cardiologists within 30 days. And I think that the main thing that we were most surprised is the fact that we observed that patients with comorbidities and those with higher risk of future adverse cardiovascular events were paradoxically less likely to receive follow-up care. And I'll give you one example that was striking to me. We thought that, you know, patient who had a heart attack and, you know, coming to the emergency room with assessment of chest pain and, you know, didn't have a heart attack and they were subsequently discharged and would have more follow-up. And in fact, this was not the case. And in fact, it was the opposite. So this patient with heart attack actually has a less likelihood of getting follow-up down the road, which is quite opposite than what we would think in clinical practice. And actually, we saw that, you know, lower likelihood of follow-up in a lot of other comorbidities as well. Instead, we found that physician follow-up after chest pain visits were strongly driven by non-clinical factors, such as access of care. So, you know, I think that one of the most striking thing was that when we looked at, you know, the highest, you know, likelihood of follow-up, we found that people who had a primary physician visit were 6 times more likely to see their primary care physician follow-up afterwards. And also people with established relationship with cardiologists were also 3 times more likely to see a cardiologist. Also, you know, I think we found some structural characteristics, such as if you got discharged at an emergency department with high volume, you were about twice as likely to see a cardiologist. So I think this is somewhat at odds with clinical practice. I think what we would expect is that, you know, people who need it most would get the most follow-up. And in fact, you know, it's based on really whether they have prior access or not. So this is kind of, I think, the most striking finding that we felt in our study.
That's fascinating. Now, let me take you back a little bit, Dennis, because sure. People will be wondering about the data set and how you identified these patients. I see you used the National Ambulatory Care Reporting System database. Yep. How accurate is that? How did you identify these patients and what were the characteristics that you used to identify this group of patients?
Yeah, so we actually used the administrative database that housed at ISIS, the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences, where I'm a senior scientist there. And we linked up that database with a lot of database that's available to us, such as the drug databases, the follow-up databases, the OHIP billing, as well as administrative databases. So I think that, you know, when we looked in previously studies to validate these characteristics, it's pretty good. I think one of the limitations that we don't have is that we don't have all the clinical characteristics of this patient. So we don't really have characteristics such as, you know, how their chest pain is like. We don't have the laboratory investigations and things like that. But in terms of the comorbidities, as well as the admission diagnosis, we felt that this is pretty accurate in this database.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that struck me was, you know, of these patients who weren't followed up, yep, how, you know, were these patients with genuine cardiac chest pain? And how can we identify? Of course, that's difficult to identify from a database, yep, but I was interested, you identified these patients as being of particularly high risk.
That's correct. I think that it is, you know, because we don't have the clinical characteristics of how their chest pain is, you know, whether it's angina or non-cardiac chest pain, we felt that taking the highest risk cohort would be the most reasonable because we felt that most of those patients would probably need follow-up. So we looked at people with diabetes, who had a prior heart attack, who had heart failure. And actually, in fact, our first paper was to look at whether it's beneficial or not. And we looked at physician follow-up and compared the outcomes to people who did not. And we showed that there was a lower chance of having, you know, either myocardial infarction or death. And so I think that gave us some confidence to say, well, we might not be able to identify the chest pain characteristics, but, you know, seeing a physician is definitely important for this cohort. And that's why we kind of sought to look at more factors associated with why they were not getting physician follow-up down the road as our subsequent paper.
When you say physician follow-up, yep, what would you really have in mind? What should we be thinking about in terms of physician follow-up?
I think physician follow-up, when they see a doctor after the initial emergency visit, I think there are a few opportunities to improve care. I think one is that in the Canadian setting, you know, when you go to the hospital with chest pain, I think the main job of the emergency physician doctor is really to rule out a heart attack. And if they don't have, you know, significant ECG changes, if they don't have positive enzymes to identify heart attack, they would leave it up to the follow-up physician to evaluate care. So I think they, as a cardiologist, you know, I would see this patient and often I would do, you know, a stress test to evaluate the extent of ischemia or whether this is maybe non-cardiac and they might not need any further therapy. And also, I think there are opportunities to improve care. You know, for example, you know, if people who had ischemic chest pain, sometimes they get, you know, put on more secondary prevention medication. Sometimes they get referred for cardiac catheterization and subsequent coronary vascularization. And that's what we have seen as well. We saw that when we compare patient who had physician follow-up versus no physician follow-up, there was significant difference in the processes of care, such as use of medication, use of cardiac catheterization, use of, you know, revascularization procedures like angioplasty or bypass surgery, when you have follow-up versus when you don't.
Yeah, I mean, the interventional aspect is very interesting. One of the things that I picked out and was a in your paragraph on the patient characteristics stratified by follow-up, and that is about the patients who saw a cardiologist in the emergency department. It seems that only 2.5 of patients actually had a consultation with a cardiologist, and 0.5% had a stress test. So how does that sound to you as a cardiologist?
I think that, you know, in Ontario, the access to a cardiologist as well as stress tests in the hospital, in the emergency room varies a lot. So I think I work in Toronto in an academic center, is, you know, access to a cardiologist is much easier. But even that, to get a stress test within a few hours, it's quite difficult. Particularly, you know, currently there are a lot of initiatives to shorten the wait time in the emergency room. And often we're, you know, we're being pushed to have a decision of whether a patient should be admitted to be discharged within a few hours. So I think that is quite consistent with the clinical context that, you know, I think most of the decisions are based by the emergent physician, and the main job is to rule out myocardial infarction. And less likely, I think they would consult us when they're not certain. And rarely we base these decisions based on, you know, our clinical findings. And it's, you know, we don't have a lot of testing to help to assist this decision.
Yeah, what struck me, and perhaps it's a little bit unfair to extrapolate from this study, was that isn't the current movement towards very immediate access to interventional cardiology, and it seemed that many of these patients didn't have immediate access to interventional cardiology?
Yeah, so I think that cohort is a bit different. So I think if you have identified a heart attack, so for example, people with ST semen elevation myocardial infarction, large heart attack, I think the system in Ontario is such that, a lot of patients go directly to the cath lab and would get an intervention quite early. So I think this is a population that is not identified of having a heart attack yet. And so I think it's interesting because I think this group of patients is much larger than the people with a heart attack. So if you look at, anybody who comes in into the hospital with chest pain, the majority of them actually gets discharged. And I think the access for these patients are quite different from the ones who had identified heart attack. I think this is what we found here, is that, a very small minority of them get to see a cardiologist after discharge.
Dennis, another thing that struck me, and my background is as a primary care physician, was the huge ratio relative to patients who had seen a primary care physician before. And what do you think does that mean? How would you interpret that figure?
Yeah, we thought that was interesting too. I think that it's really an access issue. So I think that when these patients get discharged, they are often advised to, well, why don't you go and see a family physician, check it out, make sure it's okay. For the ones that have a family physician, I think they it's fine. I think they call up the family physician and get an appointment. But for the ones who do not have a family physician, where do they go? Like, I think that it's very difficult to find a new family physician to take that advice. And I think that's what we see for people who has no established relationship with a doctor. It is quite difficult to get a new physician within, a few days to a month to see somebody when you just get discharged from the emergency room. I think that's what we observe, and that's why the odds ratio, it was six times more likely.
Yeah.
It's so high, yeah.
Yeah, that was very striking. So access, you think, is the issue. Perhaps it may be worth looking at the ER link with family physicians to try and ensure that patients like that do have follow-up with the family physician.
Yeah, I think so. I think at this time, I think most of the emergency room has little contact with the family physician, at least it's in my experience. I think that, this is one of the things that that potentially should change over time. I think right now there's been a lot of incentives to have these rapid chest pain center or rapid referral center to say, well, the emergency room can book an appointment for these patients because it is quite difficult to call up the family doctor to get an appointment for these patients. So instead, there are these new rapid referral centers, to get these patient rapid follow-up. But I think that is something that is of interest. But unfortunately, I don't think our system is set up that way that the emergency room can call the family physician office very quickly to get patients' appointment.
Dennis, can I ask you about something that I find very intriguing in the paper? And I think it's your own hypothesis. I find it really very interesting. And that's the treatment risk paradox, which you describe. And I think you described it in a previous paper. Perhaps you'd explain a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think we have looked at this aspect almost more than a decade ago. And, previously we looked at the use of statin therapy or lipid-lowering therapy. So we felt that, it's a concept of relative risk versus absolute risk. So if you apply a therapy to a low-risk patient, although the therapy is the same, your absolute risk reduction is quite small. So let's say there's a 30-year-old person with high cholesterol. You have to treat a lot of them to prevent one death because, their survival is so high. On the other hand, if you have a 75-year-old person with high cholesterol, treating them with lipid-lowering therapy with statin, your number needed to treat is much lower, meaning that you don't have to treat 1,000 person. You might need to treat like 50 people to save one life. And the treatment risk paradox is a term that we use when we observe this phenomenon that instead of the older person having more treatment, or at least the same as the younger person, most of our therapy is concentrated on the younger person with low risk. So we observe, the use of lipid-lowering therapy, the use of, invasive therapy are all concentrated on person with a lower risk. So I think that is the issue, that the high-risk patient often gets ignored or in some way biased against, because, it is more difficult to treat somebody at high risk. And so it's kind of just opposite to what it should happen if you are looking at the efficiency of the system.
Dennis, could you summarize just the main points, what you feel the main message of the paper is for our listeners?
Yeah, I think that, if I were to summarize it, in Ontario, in this cohort of patients with high-risk characteristics, such as those with diabetes or prior cardiac condition, I think the first gap in knowledge is that, about 1 in 4 patients do not get any follow-up within 30 days of the emergency room visit. And then the second thing is that these patients who do not get visits are mainly because they have less access to prior physician visit. And also the third point is that how we manage them in terms of physician follow-up is not based on the clinical characteristics. So such as high-risk patients or the people who had more chance of having a heart attack did not get more visits. In fact, they got less visit. So I think those are the main points of the paper. I think in emergency room, we need to think about who are the vulnerable population, who we really need to make sure they have a physician follow-up after their discharge.
We've been speaking today to Dr. Dennis Koh from the Institute of Clinical Evaluative Science at the Department of Medicine Sunnybrook Health Centre at the University of Toronto. Dennis, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.